those. It's Ray Richardson on WLOB 100.5 FM.
You're listening to 100.5 FM. We're broadcasting live in the RowAutoGroup.com studio. Don't forget, our McVetty's Hearth and Home text line is 207-409-6172. You can find out more at stovesofmaine.com. Well, there was an important case argued before the United States Supreme Court yesterday regarding transgender rights. I'll make it simple like that. Sarah Parshall Perry will make it much more complicated for us, but then explain it all so that you and I can understand it. But I'm going to replay something I played yesterday very quickly before we have Sarah on.
We don't want suicidal ideation, et cetera, but wonder if there is enough data as of now to prove that it is beneficial to allow these sort of treatments before the age of 18.
So I would say three things. And the first is we have decades of both clinical experience and research data showing that this is medical treatment that provides critical benefits to adolescents who need it. And so this is not new. This is not new medication. And so we have that information. We have long-term studies that track people for 5-6 years. The Supreme Court this week heard arguments in an FDA case in which the FDA referred to long-term as being 6 months of follow-up. Here we have.
All right, I'm going to pull this down. This is Chase. I believe it's pronounced Stranglo. I'm not being disrespectful if it's not. The first transgender person to argue before the United States Supreme Court yesterday. I wanted to play that portion of the clip because he was on with Jake Tapper of CNN making claims that were completely shot down yesterday by facts at the United States Supreme Court. Attorney Sarah Parshall Perry from the Heritage Foundation is joining us now. Sarah, good morning.
Thanks for having me, and I appreciate the Jefferson Starship version of Sarah, which is my favorite version, by the way.
Well, I figured it might be because it's completely awesome, and it's upbeat, and my favorite line, because having gotten to know you over the last 6 months, there are storms brewing in your eyes. There's no doubt about that.
Oh, yes. Yeah, just ask my kids. They'll verify that for me, too.
So let me ask you a couple of quick questions, because, you know, I'm a layman. I mean, I've studied the law for the last 40 years, but I'm a layman. Immutable. To me, that means, by definition, unchanging. For example, if you're talking about theology, you would say that God is immutable. He doesn't change. Yesterday, Sam Alito made the point about, is this, you're talking about immutable in the context of civil rights. Typically, we apply civil rights to things that don't change, like skin color and that sort of thing. Can you expand on that point for a moment?
Yeah, that was actually a line of questioning that stood out to me among, I think, some of the highlights of yesterday's argument. So generally, under the Equal Protection Clause, we're looking at special protection for classes of individuals who have these characteristics that are derived from what the court has called accident of birth. In other words, you were just born this way. And you're right, race, sex, national origin, ethnicity, those are the types of issues that we want to protect because individuals cannot do anything about protecting those particular characteristics. Well, that was an alternative argument presented by the United States and by the ACLU. They argued that the law that restricted certain gender-affirming, and I'm using very big air quotes, as you know, Ray, care procedures for minors under the age of 18, discriminated on the basis first of sex, and that was an immutable characteristic. Well, I will get into that in a little bit, but they also argued as an alternative theory, if the justices didn't buy that the law discriminated based on sex, then they wanted the justices to buy their alternative argument, which was it discriminated based on transgender status. And that, too, was an immutable characteristic. Well, Justice Alito decimated that argument. He specifically referenced something called the CAS report
right.
coming out of England, talked about the science, but took real issue with exactly the individual that you were playing, Chase Strangio, who is, believe it or not, a biological woman presenting as a man. So this is a transgender individual themselves who argued that, yes, transgenderism was immutable. But he said, what about gender fluid individuals? What about people who are non-binary? What about people who decide they're going to change gender identities down the road? Chase, I think, rightly struggled and stammered. And immediately Alito came in for the kill and said, so it's not actually an immutable category, is it? And there was silence in the courtroom. And I think it was one of those moments where we immediately recognized that this had to be a law classified based on sex, because no justice in the courtroom was going to buy the transgender status is immutable alternative argument.
Yeah, you know, as we're talking, I mean, I think I know the definition of immutable, which is unchanging. And that's often used in the case of God. God is unchanging. And so transgender, by definition, isn't immutable because it is ever-changing. It can change from one gender to another and then change back. As you know, many people who change while they're under the age of 18, not all by any stretch, but many people do what they call detransition later in life in their 20s when they realize, oh my God, that was a phase. So how in the world could that be immutable and therefore qualify as a civil right?
Well, that's exactly it. And Amy Coney Barrett actually brought this up as well, because when the attorney, the U.S. Solicitor General, Elizabeth Prelogar, argued for the United States and the Biden administration, there was some discussion about immutability and transgenderism as being an immutable characteristic as well. And she pointed out, and this is something I've studied for years being a civil rights lawyer, there had been other arguments before the court on other categories requested to be considered immutable, to be considered for equal protection clause status. Cases on age, cases on poverty, cases on mental disability. Every time it has come before the court has struck them down and said our bright line is immutability. These characteristics you are born with, because if we get into subjective ideas or life status, things that can and do change, we're going to throw our entire canon of constitutional equal protection clause jurisprudence into disarray.
So let me ask you this question. As we talk about the word immutable, which is really important in the context of civil rights, how do you pronounce it? Is it Strangio? I'm not sure. I'm not being disrespectful.
Strangio.
Strangio. Okay.
Yes, Strangio.
It looked like an L. Apparently it was an I. But anyhow, I'm not trying to be disrespectful. I just didn't know. And it's, be honest with you, it's hard to understand him when he talks. So was the point that he was making is that the state of transgenderism is immutable, meaning that if you're transgendered, that's something that you are, and whether you change from one gender to another or back to another, the state of transgenderism is actually an immutable state within yourself. Is that the argument he was trying to make?
That's exactly the argument he was trying to make, and I think unsuccessfully, because we know that both Justice Barrett and Justice Alito decimated that argument. They took it apart. They are not willing to stray away to these internal subjective categories, these changing categories, because the next thing we know, we're going to seek constitutional anti-discrimination status for anything from, let's say, poverty status or mental disability. Listen, things can and do change. Mental disability can be addressed by medication, by therapy. Poverty level can be addressed by work programs, welfare programs. So this is something that they do not want to expand. I think rightly so. This is a canon that was developed back in the 60s during the Civil Rights era, when they were recognizing that in enforcing the Civil Rights Act, which was based on the Equal Protection Clause, they really needed a defining characteristic, or they were going to find themselves with 1,000 requests
right.
for constitutional protection.
We're talking with attorney Sarah Parshall Perry of the Heritage Foundation. So using mental instability as an example, if you treat that as immutable, meaning unchanging, then you're condemning a person to mental instability I mean, that's essentially what you're doing under the law, is saying
that's exactly it.
Yeah,
that's
mental
exactly
instability
it.
Can't change, but we know that it can with treatment and counseling and all kinds of other things. You know, one of the things that has long bugged me, I don't support this idea of transgendering children under the age of 18. I'm a great believer in freedom, and long as you're not hurting another person, if you're an adult and you do what you want to do, tattoo every inch of your body, piercings everywhere, whatever, it's not my business, you know. And I always say, you know, if you're gay, I don't care, as long as you're not a chubby chaser and come after me, you know. She laughed. She got it. But here's the thing. We're talking about children here. This entire argument, I mean, at one point, this attorney that argued, Strangio, argued, they were in an interview talking about the castration of two-year-olds, arguing that a two-year-old has the ability to make this determination. And having raised four children who are wonderful because of my wife, but I was, in fact, a bystander to it all, I know that a two-year-old couldn't articulate that sort of thing with any lucidity. It's just not possible. We're losing our cotton-picking minds in this country over this insanity. And again, we're talking about children. Joe Biden, the president of the United States, has said he believes that a child of 8 years old should be allowed to transition. We're in nut job land. We're wackadoodles here.
Yeah. And the fact that this came on so seemingly precipitously, we went from some individuals sort of at the outer perimeters of society identifying themselves as being transgender, and really for adults, and that's an entirely separate discussion, but on a grand stage, I do believe we're platforming fetishism, and that the majority of individuals who are biological males, who present as females and want to get into female spaces, are doing so for reasons that are not pure, that are not decent. But I will say, when it comes to kids, and if this is the hook on which I hang my legal career, it is going to be worth it, because I feel so passionately about this issue. I, too, am a parent. I am a single parent of three kids, ages 15, 18, 20. If my son came to me, and he did at six, and say, "Mom, I'm a firefighter. I want a costume. I want to go down to the volunteer fire station." I took him for a visit, and then he came home. You better believe I didn't send him into a burning building. You don't withhold food from an anorexic. You don't overfeed a bulimic. You don't withhold medication from somebody who has a mental disability. Why in God's name is this something that we feel the science supports, and we are going to look back on with warmth in our heart? I do believe, and I've said this publicly, I'll say it again here, this is going to be our generation's Tuskegee experiment. We are going to look back in shame and realize that we castrated an entire generation of young people, because the biggest cohort that is growing right now in terms of trans-identified individuals is ages 12 to 17. In 5 years, there has been a 4,000% increase in young girls who are this prepubescent and pubescent age identifying as transgender. 4,000% increase. That's not an organic increase. This is the influence of peer pressure, social media, sort of mainstream stars that we're seeing identify, people like Elliot Page, who was formerly Ellen Page. Young minds are so susceptible to outside influence. And is it any wonder that what we hear coming down from the federal government in the executive order out of his mouth, President Joe Biden, on the first day of his presidency, expanding sex to include gender identity in all federally funded regulations and laws, and there are more than 100 of them, that has a trickle-down effect through all of the agencies, because no one wants to turn off the government spigot that came into the classroom through government-funded schools, and the next thing we know, we have gender identity lessons in the curriculum and drag queens in kindergarten and illustrated porn in the libraries. All of this was precipitous because the people in charge in Washington, and I am a stone's throw from the Capitol, the people in charge in Washington were asleep at the wheel.
I could not agree with you more. You're absolutely right about that. And it's so funny. This is going to scare you. but I have referred to this transitioning of children to the Tuskegee experiments that were done on black men, which is what has made many black people afraid of and skeptical of our healthcare system in this country. So that should scare you, because I've used those exact words in writing and orally. It's you know, the thing is, I've had people say to me on the station, I've had them say to me in public forums, that my opposition to a child being transitioned is leading to their suicide. But the truth is, children commit suicide. Every single one of those suicides are tragic, and we wish we could prevent it. But they never talk about the children that transitioned who in their 20s are committing suicide because they realize the mistake they've made with their bodies. And they can't, particularly in the case of a male, for example, if he's castrated. I watched a 60 Minutes report. It's one of the rare times recently they've actually been fair and balanced, about a year and a half, 2 years ago. And they did a really extensive thing. And they also put on adults who would transition as children. One of the guys said, I was castrated. What do I do now? Because I'm a man. You know, again, aren't we told, Sarah, correct me if I'm wrong, because I am a very simple guy, aren't we told that brains aren't really fully formed until the early 20s?
25 years old is when the prefrontal cortex is fully functional, operational, and developed. And let me tell you, as the parent of a 20-year-old, he's got a couple of years left.
Yeah, of course. And so the point here is if the brain is not fully formed until you're 25 years old, why are not only we allowing but encouraging these life-altering decisions? As you rightfully pointed out, your 6-year-old wanted to be a firefighter. You let him go down to the fire station, but you did not allow him to run into a burning building, because at the age of 6 years old, he's incapable of doing anything about it, even if that is his life's calling. And this is my entire argument here. So Alito, who I thought was pretty eloquent on this whole thing, at one point brought up the CAST report that you referred to earlier, and he referred to page 195 when they were talking about suicidal ideation. And the report blows all of that up. It's an extensive report, and it blows all of that up. And you know, I think part of it is that. You know, I get it. As a parent, we weren't sure how to approach the idea of suicide, because as a parent, if you talk with your children about suicide, are you giving the concept validity? And I was worried about it, really worried about it. But we made the decision to talk to them about it in the context of, there was nothing that you and I and your mother and God Almighty couldn't solve if you just bring it to us. Whatever you do, don't create a permanent solution to a temporary situation. And that's how we approached it. And again, I don't want to diminish it. Suicide is awful. I don't care if you're 1 year old or if you're 100 years old. Every suicide is a tragedy. But to use this as a tool, or let me rephrase that, to use this as a weapon in this fight to mutilate children is disgraceful and it's demonic.
How many times have we heard the trope, would you rather have a living daughter or a dead son? And I have to tell you, that moment where he specifically cited page 195 of the CAST report to Chase Strangio, who was, again, taking the podium, and he was talking about how these are life-saving care because they prevent mental health illness, they prevent suicide. Then Alito went right to the evidence and cited the CAST report saying, there is no evidence that this increases suicidality. And Chase Strangio had to cop to that. He said that that's actually right. We have no data that this increases suicides. Now, it increases thoughts of suicide. And I'm thinking, well, how do you conceivably track that? First of all, because it's entirely subjective. But second of all, I don't know of any young person who hasn't been through a dark period during their pubertal years. That's because hormones are funny things. And I don't think anyone's gotten through ages 12 to 18 without a little bit of emotional ups and downs, without some crying jags, without feeling as though they're being left out. That is the nature of the beast. It is a rough time for kids, middle school, high school. People are figuring out who they are. Then you add on top of this, these life-altering chemicals that are castrating children, chemically castrating children. And I want everyone who's listening to remember that Lupron is what they give sex offenders in prison to castrate them.
You are absolutely right about that. You know, you alluded to it earlier, but I want to go back to it because it's really important. And it's important in the context of Maine. So Gallup, as you may know, does a survey every year. It's about 880,000 people. It's the most extensive survey that I've ever seen, trying to determine the level of the LGBTQIA community in this country. And historically and even currently, that is always teetered around 7.7% of the population identifies in that group. Internationally, it's about 3%. Now, the reason I cite those statistics is in the state of Maine, according to Maine's government, that's where this stat comes from, in Maine high schools, 29.3% of students identify as LGBTQIA. Now, you tell me, is this a natural occurrence within the child, or is this an environment? And I would say that this is an indoctrinational environment.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd love to see the data over the past 5 and even 10 years and see exactly where the trajectory is, because I can guarantee you right now it is going nowhere but straight up. So much of this goes back to education. And listen, we've talked about this before. I was one of the senior attorneys at the Department of Education. I feel very passionately about the cause of public education, even though I think that the Department of Education is unconstitutional itself. It's going to be a while before any administration unravels it. Remember, Jimmy Carter founded it in 1979. 1980, President Ronald Reagan ran on the platform to dismantle the Department of Education because all education should be local. So yes, while I believe the Department of Education is itself unconstitutional, for kids who need, for example, like my son, specialized services, a 504 plan, an IEP plan, an individualized education environment to be able to meet their needs because of developmental disabilities, it was essential for me. I could not afford private school tuition. There were no private schools in the area, no charter schools in the area. This, unfortunately, has now become an indoctrination factory. We are not seeing kids go to learn. We know that our international scores are flagging. In Baltimore City, just south of me, we have 0 students, literally 0% of Baltimore City students proficient in math.
Isn't that extraordinary?
That is unconscionable.
Yeah,
that's exactly it. But what we are doing is we're cramming through race essentialism, critical race theory, and we are definitely cramming through gender identity.
You're absolutely right. We've talked about the Baltimore school system a lot here. In the state of Maine, our Commissioner of Education, Pinder Macon, stood before the legislative committee, the education committee of the legislature, and said that social emotional learning will take place over math, science, English, and the traditional core basics of education in the state. Under that leadership, which has now gone on for 6 years, we've seen sixth graders in the state of Maine have reading comprehension fall to its lowest rate in recorded Maine history. We are seeing our students struggle. You talked about the Department of Education at the federal level. The America's educational system has long been ranked number one in the world of industrialized nations. Depending on the matrix that you use, and there are varying ones, we rank either 13th down to 24th of industrialized nations since the inception of the Federal Department of Education. There's a reason for that. Maine's constitution calls for education to be provided for at the local level, not only the curriculum, but also financing. Now, it doesn't preclude a state or federal assistance in that realm of money, but it calls for that because the founders of this state in 1820 understood that education that was local was best.
That's exactly it, as it should be. And I think really, and I've said this before, the most important political races in the country right now are school boards.
Sure.
Because I'm going to tell you that is, you capture young minds go on to proliferate good ideas, but they are so resilient, they are so responsive, they are such a fertile mental ground for indoctrination. And this is part of the reason, and I just released a comprehensive paper on the parameters of the parental right, not just under the Constitution, right? We're very familiar with what the Supreme Court has said about the care, upbringing, and education of one's minor child, but also under federal statute and local law. Parents need to understand exactly how many rights they have. I think they would be more emboldened to march into their local public school and demand access to the program.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right about that. And well, you saw what happened, though. And they understood very clearly. Miguel Cardona, who is the education secretary under not Barack Obama, Joe Biden, you know, they're one and the same as far as I'm concerned. Both terrible. You remember what happened here as parents begin to rise up. As you talked about the book earlier, you alluded to it, Gender Queer, the pornographic book that's in elementary school libraries. Parents begin to rise up around the country. What did Miguel Cardona do? Well, he pulled one over on the people. As you know, the National School Boards Association sent a letter to Cardona and to Merrick Garland, the attorney general, concerned about parents being involved in the school board. And Merrick Garland referred to them as domestic terrorists. But here was the big lie of the whole thing. This was not organic. The National School Boards Association did not do this on their own. Miguel Cardona, as has come out, requested that letter because he wanted to use the Justice Department to dampen parental influence and involvement at the school board level. I don't know why that wasn't a national story, but it's a fact. Anybody can look it up.
Yeah, I was surprised that did not get more traction, and I actually worked with the organization that filed the FOIAs that resulted in the revelation of the NSBA memo to the Department of Justice, to the Department of Education, where they were saying, you know, these are domestic terrorists. We're worried about increasing threats at school board meetings. And as a result of their Freedom of Information Act request, they got access to the memo and the story broke. But as many stories do when they are in the mainstream media, it was nothing more than a blip for a short period of time. So it was incumbent upon people like you, Ray, to be able to cover this story so that parents understand exactly the level of threat that they are to teachers and administrators. And by threat, I don't mean physical threat. I don't mean domestic terrorists. I mean ideological threat. I mean parents who are seeking to take back their primary authority to direct their children's upbringing, to be the one most responsible for planting these ideas, for inculcating world values within their kids. It is not, these are not creatures of the state. The Supreme Court's actually used that language in Pierce versus Society of Sisters in 1925. The child is not a mere ward of the state. They belong to their parents, and I would love for parents to just stand firm in that knowledge and make themselves a nuisance at their local public school.
Well, and we should think about this, although most people don't know history. It's unfortunate because it doesn't seem to be a subject people want to teach in the school system. And when I refer to modern, I refer to the last 100 years. We know the most egregious example of when children were seen as a ward of the state about 80 years ago. And we know how that all worked out. Worked out terribly, not only for the parents and the people of Germany, it worked out terribly for the rest of the world, who had to end up fighting that evil in order to stop it. And my only point here is, God gave children to mom and dad. That was his plan. Now, not every family is mom and dad. I get all that. And that's not to denigrate one family or another, but that was the original design. Nowhere, nowhere in that construct was G-O-V considered.
That's exactly it. It really, and it's something that we didn't feel we'd ever have to argue for. I just hosted a parents' rights symposium, and one of the panelists made a great point. She's a litigator in this space, and she's trying to protect kids from the onslaught of the transgender agenda. And she said, you know, this is a right that none of us had to think about. 100 years ago, we all took it for granted, until we got to a point where the public education system, and of the 13 challenges at the Supreme Court, most of them have been involved with education vis-a-vis the parental right. We've had one case on visitation. We've had another case on vaccination. We've had one on mental health care. But most of the cases are when education and the parental right collide. For 100 years, the state government have felt as though their government-run schools puts them in a position of godlike authority in the lives of these mother, these young children. But we have to not forget that in loco parentis does not mean in toto parentis.
Right.
We're giving our children over for temporary daily custody for a purpose that our taxpayer dollars pay for, and then they send them home. Their job is not to create future Marxists and to indoctrinate them during the 9-to-5 hour. It is our responsibility to raise those children in the path that they should go.
No, you're absolutely right about that. I used to tell the school system, you need to understand the fact that I'm allowing you to educate my children is your privilege. It is a responsibility that you bear, but it is your privilege because my children are precious and they are a gift that I'm sharing with you. And I would say this to teachers and they would look at me like, what are you talking about? I'm like, you don't understand here. You're not the one in control. I'm in control. My wife is in control. And we didn't have many conflicts with the school. I want to be very clear about that. I feel like my daughter, Elizabeth, who just turned 26, was the last child in the Westbrook Public School System to get a proper education. There was a point where something changed after she left the school. I don't know what it was, but it has changed dramatically. And if you talk to the students, they will tell you that, but nobody wants to listen to them because, well, they're kids. They can change their gender when they're kids, but if they want to tell you what's actually happening, we can't hear it. It's just extraordinary.
Right.
Sarah, we unfortunately have got to go. I could talk to you for the entire 4 hours of my show. You make me better. Thank you.
Well, thank you for saying that. It is always a pleasure, and look forward to the next time we can chat.
Next Thursday. Same bat time, same bat channel. Sarah Parsha-Perry, as always, thanks a lot for being on. I appreciate it. It is 7:36. Dave Chulo is going to join us now. I know we ran late, but I think it was too important. It was very, very important to hear what Sarah had to say. Yesterday was a landmark case before the court. Landmark in many, many different ways. And again, I want to be very clear to anyone listening. And I know people like to make up boogeyman stories about me, and they write them in some of the crappy newspapers in the state. I've read the stuff. Occasionally people will send it to me. If you're gay, I don't care. If you're lesbian, I don't care. If you're transgender, I don't care. As long as you're an adult. But when the system decides to take a child at 8 years old and transition that child, and as you know, in the state of Maine, the creepy, greasy, grimy wackadoodles in Augusta in the last session passed a law that allowed minor children to begin transitioning without parental consent. And they forced law enforcement in the state of Maine to stand down if that child is from another state who crossed into our state. They, in effect, created a transgender sanctuary in this state. These people in Augusta that you, not me, reelected, because I wouldn't vote for a damn Democrat now if my life depended on it. If you held a gun to my head and said, cast a ballot for a Democrat, I'd let you pull the trigger. I swear to God that's true because I don't fear death. I will go to heaven. After what they did here in Maine in the last session, I will never vote for another Democrat again. I have done so, but I will never do it again. Never. I don't care if it was my own brother, who, by the way, is a Republican, so it wouldn't happen. I will not vote for a Democrat after what these people did to the state that I cherish and love. They're out of their minds. They have no business being in public office. Some of them ought to be in jail for what they've done to the state. All right, we're going to move on. It's time. Dave Chulo is joining us, and he's going to bring us some exciting news about the Paid Family and Medical Leave Act that Woodcock, what's his first name? Dadgummit, from the state chamber. I can't think of his first name. He's the head of the state chamber. Was out yesterday talking about that the state once again has, well, messed up its implementation. Dave Chulo, good morning.
Hey, good morning. You know, there was the final regulations came out yesterday. And it's 65-plus pages. And I would be remiss to say that I've studied all 65-plus pages as of this morning. But the fact is, there's still a lot more questions than answers. The regulations may have come out, but the interpretation of the regulation is what really matters. And so, actually, we're looking at that. We have a bunch of attorneys that are looking at it as well, as and that all information should come out sometime next week. But let's talk about what we do know. And we do know that as of the first payroll period here in January, we will start the deduction of the 1%, 0.5% from employees, 0.5% from employers, with the exception, of course, if an employer is less than 15 employees, then it's only the 0.5% for employees will start coming out of paychecks. And if you use a payroll company such as ADP or Paychex or another Bangor payroll, any of the payroll companies, that should automatically happen. But I do encourage every employer to double check with their payroll company to make sure that everything is being set up. Of course, employers do have the choice, if they so choose, to pay both sides of that equation. But then that is 100% up to the employer. And the only reason I mention that is because the Department of Labor has put out advertising, and that is part of the advertising to let employees and everybody know that that is possible. You can actually see it on YouTube. You can go to the main Department of Labor, and they have some of the YouTube videos. They also have, of course, videos for employers and employees that have been recorded. The state is getting ready to launch its new portal for the main paid family leave. That will be done in January, though they did a webinar, I believe it was last week, to show you how to enter the portal. Of course, there's nothing to enter it into at this point, but the video is out there now in terms of how to put the information in. So the most important thing you need to know today is that you have to be able to make sure that you start the payroll collection of the money that's going to be going to start this fund or this fund, basically, which is going to house the money that's going to start this program. If you're going to ask me all the different rules and regulations about how that happens, the truth is, even after we read the 65 pages, I talked to one attorney already, there's still so many questions to be answered. Not a surprise, by the way, of course, Ray, right?
Well, I agree. I read it yesterday, and there are an awful lot of questions here. On the name I was forgetting, first name was Patrick Woodcock. I was thinking of Seth or Chandler, but Patrick Woodcock, he's the president of the Maine State Chamber. And again, he's a guy I like and respect. And he came out yesterday and he made a statement about the implementation here. But here's my argument with every one of these dadgum organizations in the state. They always soften their statement by, and here's his statement, his direct quote, "The Maine State Chamber recognizes the Maine Department of Labor is operating against an extremely tight timeline to meet the state Paid Family and Medical Leave Act Programs Law, January 1, 2025 implementation deadline, and we appreciate the MDOL's diligence and efforts over the last several months." That's how he starts his statement. Well, at that point, you've essentially exonerated them of the criticism because they're under such pressure, except that that's manure, because this was passed in the spring of 2023. We pay these people to actually work. I know most of them don't, but what in the hell? A monkey could have designed this program in 20 months.
There are plenty of other examples of this program throughout the country. As you probably know, we are not the first state to do this.
No, we're not. I've talked about it a lot.
13th or 15th, I don't remember the exact number. But the truth is that there are plenty of programs. There are some uniquenesses to Maine, and that is, of course, going to have to come out in how they implement it. But the reality is that they took a while to get everything going. But, you know, I don't think anybody listening today, anybody, is totally surprised that it took a longer time to set up a government and brand new program. I don't think there's anybody that has any shock and awe.
No, we're not shocked, Dave, but here's the point. This wasn't implemented in October with an extremely tight deadline of January 1. This was done almost 20 months ago. What is it these people are doing? I know they're not answering the phones for labor claims because people every day text me and say whenever they lost their job, they're trying to find out if they can claim unemployment, which, by the way, is paid for as a tax on your payroll, and nobody will answer the phone and nobody will call them back. We have people from the pandemic now 4 years later who have never gotten a phone call back. Just what in the hell are these people doing? And the answer is they're getting pay creases and they're getting bonuses from Janet Mills, but they're not doing their dadgum job. 20 months, a monkey could design this. But as you rightfully pointed out, we don't have to reinvent the wheel. There are many states around the country who have these. Ours is a little different. We could have made modifications and taken their blueprint. So my argument with all of these so-called business advocate organizations is every time there is an imposition placed on business in this state, if they go to criticize them, the first thing they do is soften the criticism to where it loses its sting, saying we know you're on a tight deadline. No, you're not. 20 months is forever.
Well, as you know and I know, that's politics. And they do that because they know that they're not in the strength position that they could be in. And this is a state that has been one-sided for a long time. And so if there is any criticism, it can be held against them. And that's the truth. We know it. That's facts.
Yeah, but the bottom line here is the DOL hasn't changed. Most of them are entrenched bureaucracy. Most of them are. And the fact is, Janet wasn't up for election in this election that happened. None of her team was going to change. She hasn't fired Laura Fortman for the inextricably terrible job she's done as Labor Commission. It's another example of somebody having experience and actually being worse at the job the second time around. And here we are again. Here we are again. And now businesses have been hitting me all morning long because they saw that this came out yesterday. Yesterday was December the 4th. This was 19 months ago. And when it actually takes place, it'll be 20 months. And again, Dave, you pointed out, my argument was instead of doing it the dumb way they did it because they wanted this pool of money, they knew they needed this pool of money they could pull from to try to balance the budget because they're not paying benefits for 18 or 20 months, depending on the timeline, my idea would have been revolutionary, which was to go in and change the word disability in the law and allow short-term and long-term disability policies to include a paid family and leave act. I argued for that vociferously here. Of course, they ignored it because it made common sense. But we had blueprints all around the country. This was not difficult. They were not creating a revolutionary document here.
You know, it's going to be interesting on the short-term disability side because there are a lot of organizations that are looking at whether or not they should continue to have that as an option for their employees. And, of course, nothing I think is going to change until that 18 or 20 months from now when we make some decisions in 2026. But the truth is that there is some question about if it's redundant, how that's going to be covered. If it has to be purchased in the way that it is today, I am sure the insurance companies will adjust that to maybe make it different. But the fact is, that is a really good question that a lot of employers do ask us. And we don't have answers today because we obviously need to see how this thing is going to roll out and make that happen. So, yeah, look, at this point, I think employers need to know what they need to do, right? And they need to get ready for literally in 3 weeks to be able to start getting the money collected. It has to be put, if you're going to do it yourself, it has to be put in by the end of the quarter, end of first quarter, and so into the portal. And if not, of course, then it's going to be done by your payroll company. The other thing I will say is that I mentioned the fact about the portal, and once it launches, all employers are going to have to go in and sign up on the portal. So I think that's also an important part. And we'll get more information about that today. Later this next year.
I mean, this is just such nutter nonsense. I've argued against this the whole time. But once again, Janet Mills completely broke her word to the people of Maine, said she would not raise taxes on people. This is a payroll tax paid for by the employee and the employer. It was not a necessity to be done the way it was done. This was done because of power and money. No other reason. But here's the really good part to it all, and this is what everybody ought to understand. No matter how messed up the 65-page document that explains this is, your money will be taken from your paycheck, the money that you earned by the state government starting on January 1, 2025, no matter how messed up the implementation of this program is.
That's 100% true. And the other thing that's interesting is there are going to be private plan options, which, according to the Department of Labor and the authority who is going to be in charge of this, they'll look at whether or not you can use the private plan. There are private plan insurance companies coming into the state talking about they'll be able to match and so forth and so on. But the truth is all the money you put in, especially during first quarter and until it's approved in second quarter, you're going to be putting that money into the public plan, and it is very clear you are not getting that money back.
Right.
So whether or not you're going to use it, you will not be able to use it, of course, if that's the case. But there is no way to retract that money or get it back if you go on a private plan. That doesn't in any way discourage or make a decision for an employer, but just be aware that that's the facts.
Dave, correct me if I'm wrong, and I could be. I mean, I read the document, but, I do miss things. I'm human. They didn't name the administrator of the plan.
To my knowledge, that has not been named yet.
So here we are. We're 20 months in. This was passed 20 months ago. The implementation, which was described by a 65-page document, has so many holes in it that you could run a semi through it. We know that they're going to take the money from the people and the employer starting on January 1, 2025, about 3 weeks from now. But we don't know exactly how the plan is going to operate because the 65-page document has a great lack of clarity. And we don't even know who is administrating the plan, but they are going to get the money. I hope everybody focuses on that.
There was also an update that came out for the Q&As, which is separate from the 65-plus-page document. So there are Q&As. Again, you can all go to the main Department of Labor website, go under the Family Medical Leave tab or section, and all this stuff is there, the videos, the information, the Q&As and all that. But, there is just some questions. I will say that, I read through it. Doesn't mean I deciphered everything yet, in fairness. But there has been this question in regards to whether – well, first of all, the money is pre-tax, to be very clear. That is 100% clear in how it's being taken out. That's one. Second, there is not a definitive answer from the IRS yet in regards to whether or not employers are going to be able to look at this money as whether they can use it like health insurance or other areas and how it's going to affect employer taxes. So I want to be very clear, there is no answer to this. According to the Maine Department of Labor, the authority, they are negotiating with the IRS to determine how that's going to be done. So I know that there's been questions coming to me in regards to, how are we going to be able to do that? In no way am I a tax accountant, and I would encourage you to talk to your tax accountant. But when I spoke to mine, there is no answers today. So you may have to start the program as it is and get clarity later on how that works.
Well, think about, this is part and parcel for the Mills administration. This is how they operate. You remember the checks they sent out to the citizens last year or the year before, and they never got clarity from the Internal Revenue Service as to whether someone had to declare that as income or not. After the fact, when it became an issue, they did finally get clarity from the IRS, and people weren't taxed on it. But the point was, they don't do the due diligence. These are very sloppy people that we pay a lot of money to wreck our government. I really don't understand what happened in the election. These are the same people that are doing the same stuff, and we're not better for it, and yet we put them back into office. I don't understand it. I guess Maine people have either A, accepted mediocrity from our government, or less than mediocrity, or we just aren't suffering enough yet. I don't know what the answer is, but I'm hoping there'll be a clear change in 2026. And to every organization out there that is making statements about this, that you're upset about it, you're upset about that 65-page document, you're upset the fact that it came out 3 weeks after 19 months of it being out and available and in law, stop giving them a pass. Patrick Woodcock, I respect the heck out of you. but your entire statement was mitigated by the fact that you know how hard they're working and they're on such a tight deadline. A monkey could have designed this by hitting random keys on the keyboard in 19 months. Give me a break.
You are channeling your inner Bill Clinton in that little bit there.
I know. Lord have mercy. So let's go to something happy here. How was Thanksgiving?
Oh, Thanksgiving was wonderful. It's always a wonderful time. I give thanks every day, but certainly that weekend was wonderful. And it was very quiet. We had just my wife and I, and it was very, very quiet. Everybody else was away, and so yeah, that's good. It gave us time, as you know, to put up Christmas trees. Right?
Absolutely, and you got a lot of those. I meant to call you, and I apologize for being so remiss in not doing so. But this past weekend was the first weekend that we did not carry the HR Power Hour, as you were on about 2 weeks ago and explained why you were discontinuing the show after 13 years. I got many text messages about they missed the HR Power Hour. So I thought you should know that. You created something people really appreciated and learned from.
Well, thank you. And I got to tell you, I enjoy it. Now I get to do it in a shortened version on your show every 2 weeks on Thursday from 7:30 to 8, right? That's the way I look at it. It's still information that's going to be provided. Of course, you can still go to hrpower.com and look at all the shows that have been done over the last 13 years. Tawny and I, of course, did the final show and recap just the changes that have occurred in HR over 13 years. Just think about that for just a second, Ray. It's insane.
It is. Well, and I know your favorite part of calling in on Thursday is coming up with something that just gets me wound up beyond wound up.
I will have that for next year, but I knew for next week, but I, oh, next 2 weeks, I should say. But I knew that we'd be talking about maintain family medical leave, which is just a mouthful to talk about.
It certainly is. Dave Chulo, as always, we appreciate you and all that you do. Thanks for being on this morning.
Well, thank you very much, Ray. Have a great day, everyone.
You as well. We have got to run. 7:56.
We fix people by fixing their car. I like being part of that.
It's a great feeling knowing that you've done something that looks good and you know the customer is going to be happy with.
We're doing great. I love my job. I